This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 25th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, we take an in-depth look at CIA torture practices and a formerly classified report that was released yesterday.
John Ashcroft knew that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times.
In Afghanistan, military contractors are outnumbering U.S. troops. And we go to India, where a severe drought has crippled the local economy and unleashed a string of farmer suicides.
What is significantly different about this time's drought is that it is a triple effect. Firstly, you have a global meltdown. Secondly, there is a global food crisis that is ongoing.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Afghanistan today, officials announced preliminary election results as coordinated bomb blasts in Kandahar killed scores. Some observers say the turmoil could lead to civil war. Free Speech Radio News's Asma Namadi has more.
At 5 p.m. in Kabul and throughout the country, ears and eyes were glued to radios and television waiting for preliminary voting results for Afghanistan's second presidential elections. With 10% of ballots counted, incumbent Hamid Karzai is barely ahead of Dr. Abdullah Abdullah. Karzai had 40.6% of those votes, while Abdullah garnered 38.6%. The Independent Elections Commission, however, announced that final results will not be in until the 3rd of September. Moreover, Dr. Abdullah is charging Mr. Karzai's campaign of election fraud, telling the Associated Press in a meeting early this week that Mr. Karzai rigged last week's elections and that government officials had a hand in it. Also, Abdullah's supporters are promising street violence similar to that in Iran if they believe the election was stolen. In other news, a few hours after the preliminary election results were released, five explosive-laden cars were detonated in Afghanistan's largest southern city of Kandahar. 41 people died and at least another 66 are wounded. The death toll, however, may yet increase and details of the blast are not yet known. For FSRN, this is Asma Namadi reporting from Kabul.
Security increased in Kenya today, where officials began conducting a national census. There's been contention over a question on the survey. For the first time, Kenyan officials will ask about ethnic groups. Many Kenyans say this is inappropriate after more than 1,000 people were killed in sectarian violence after elections in 2007. Officials say they need to gather tribal data to adequately address questions of discrimination in social services and resource allocation. Critics say the data is misused by politicians. The last census was taken in 1999. The government never released official results. The census is expected to continue all week. In financial news, the Congressional Budget Office announced today that the federal deficit will hit about $1.6 trillion this year. While a staggering figure and the largest deficit in the U.S. since World War II, the projection is actually slightly lower than earlier anticipated. The CBO also said that unemployment figures are expected to top out at 10%. But one guy whose job prospects look pretty good is Ben Bernanke. President Obama reappointed him today as the chair of the Federal Reserve. Bernanke said he will strive to create a solid foundation for prosperity and price stability.
The Federal Reserve, like other economic policymakers, has been challenged by the unprecedented events of the past few years. We have been bold or deliberate as circumstances demanded, but our objective remains constant: to restore a more stable financial and economic environment in which opportunity can again flourish and in which Americans' hard work and creativity can receive their proper rewards.
But confirmation is not a given. Senate Banking Committee Chair Chris Dodd wasted no time today in assuring that Bernanke will face what he called a thorough confirmation hearing. According to Palestinian health officials, three people were killed and seven wounded by airstrikes on a tunnel between the Gaza Strip and Egypt early today. The Israeli military says the strike was in response to mortar attacks into Israel yesterday, in which an Israeli soldier was injured. Across the United States, children, nursing mothers, and women in their childbearing years may face risks when drinking tap water. The NRDC says EPA monitoring of a common herbicide, atrazine, is not good enough. Free Speech Radio News's Karen Miller has more.
According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, the EPA is insufficiently monitoring atrazine in water systems. Atrazine can affect the hormone system, the development of reproductive organs, and may contribute to certain forms of cancer. Mei Wu is staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
What we are finding is that when frogs are exposed to atrazine, that they actually are becoming hermaphrodites.
Wu says because animal and human hormone systems can work the same way, this is cause for alarm.
Pregnant women who, drink water that's contaminated with high levels of atrazine, there's some concern that there might be effects on the development of the fetus. And same goes for, children and young infants who are also still developing.
The NRDC has also expressed concern for wildlife and ecosystems. They're calling for the EPA to take atrazine off the shelves. The Obama administration says it will, quote, take a hard look at the chemical. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Argentina's Supreme Court overturned a law mandating jail terms for possession of small amounts of drugs today. Justice has said that the focus should be on treatment and police should pursue major drug traffickers. While not an outright legalization of drug possession, lawmakers in Argentina have been waiting for the court to rule before proposing such a measure to Congress. In Pakistan today, another 24 bodies have been discovered in the past 24 hours, nearly all of them Taliban members. The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan says the extrajudicial killings were likely carried out by security forces, and two high-level Taliban deputies acknowledged today that their leader, Baitullah Massoud, is in fact dead. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Yesterday's release of a classified report on interrogations shows that the CIA used violence and psychological torture when questioning suspects and detainees. The secret program appears to be a covert operation working outside the confines of the law. Interrogators operated with little discretion and had no system to follow. What resulted was intense interrogations that many claim constitute torture. This is the clearest look to date at the interrogation program created after September 11th. The findings of the released information prompted Attorney General Eric Holder to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate. To get a better sense of what the report said, we now turn to FSRN's Washington editor, Leanne Caldwell. Thanks for joining us, Leanne.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Manuel.
The report reveals that interrogators operated with little discretion at the beginning of this interrogation program. What sort of actions are they talking about?
After September 11th, the U.S. started to round people up. Interrogators had no direction. They improvised. For example, interrogators and debriefers, which now have defined roles and are distinctly two different people, one goes through training, the other doesn't. Those two people in those two different positions were used interchangeably, and they had no training. The Department of Justice began to issue guidelines to the CIA in 2002, and that was the infamous memo that has since been declassified. That memo interpreted international and American law in such a way that they were not committing torture. For example, on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, it says, even though he was waterboarded 183 times, it was not torture because there was no intent to inflict severe pain.
A training program was created for interrogators in 2003, is that correct?
That was correct, yes.
Did things change after that training program was installed?
They had a list of guidelines that they could follow, and there was two levels of interrogations. One was standard interrogations, and another was enhanced interrogation tactics. And that's what we're talking about, these ones that cross the line that many allege are torture. For example, on page 15 of this report, there's a list of interrogations that have been approved. I'll read you a couple. One, it says, insects can be placed in a confinement box with the detainee. In another one, it says, with the facial or insult slap, the fingers are slightly spread apart. The interrogator's hand makes contact with the area between the tip of the detainee's chin and the bottom of the corresponding earlobe. So there are very specific guidelines to follow in these enhanced interrogation tactics, but it didn't really stop there. There was a lot of things that were going on that were being improvised. People did not seek approval before they used some of these enhanced techniques.
Does this report give us any more insights into what type of interrogations were used?
It does reveal that then Attorney General John Ashcroft knew that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times. It also gives us insights into the types of interrogations that were used that were improvised. So in the report, there's nearly 10 pages of interrogation tactics that were used that were not improved. For example, the use of a handgun or a drill in a detainee's face. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's family was threatened. The interrogator said, "We're going to kill your children," blowing cigar smoke into the face of detainees. And also there was one technique that was specifically outlawed, but that technique has been redacted and we don't know what that is.
How expansive was this interrogation program?
It's quite expansive. This happened even outside the CIA interrogation program, inside the confines of the secret prisons that were holding these detainees. Page 84 of the report reveals that a teacher at a religious school, assumingly in Afghanistan, was assaulted. This school was being investigated. An interrogator went there to talk to the teacher and talk to other people. He reportedly laughed inappropriately, and he was hit in the torso twice with the end of the rifle.
So what's going to happen with this report?
Attorney General Eric Holder has appointed a special prosecutor to open up an investigation. There are four pages of recommendations that have been recommended in this report, but those have been redacted, so we're not sure what the Inspector General recommends.
Well, great. Thanks a lot, Leanne.
Thanks so much, Manuel.
That was FSRN's Washington editor Leanne Caldwell speaking about the recently released CIA report on Bush-era torture and interrogation practices. The report, which was released by the Department of Justice, also talks about how the CIA used contractors or paramilitary officers to carry out interrogations. One part cites the example of a contractor who beats a detainee with a metal flashlight and kicks him during interrogations. The detainee dies in custody and the contractor is reassigned to another job. The report admits that the contractor, whose name is redacted, had received no training in interrogation methods. A report by the U.S. Defense Department that was recently published in the Wall Street Journal says that at the end of June, there were 74,000 contractors in Afghanistan compared to 58,000 U.S. soldiers. The number of contractors could be even higher, with two contractors for every U.S. soldier in Afghanistan. To look deeper into this issue of U.S. contractors, we're joined by Protap Chatterjee. Chatterjee is a contributing editor of CorpWatch.org, and he recently published Halliburton's Army, a book on that military contractor's dealings in Iraq. Mr. Chatterjee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How come there's more contractors than U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and what sort of functions are these contractors doing?
Afghanistan has probably twice as many contractors as it has soldiers. So 6 months ago, there were 38,000 troops and over 70,000 contractors, which is, you're correct, is a very high level. It's high, even higher than in Iraq, where it was roughly one contractor for every soldier, you know, 150,000 soldiers, 175,000 contractors. It's important to understand that this number actually comprises a great variety of people. And the bulk of these people, or at least half of them, are people working on reconstruction projects, working as policy advisors or doing sort of quite mundane work. And then you have, you know, a quarter or less that are actually involved in much more closely linked to the business of warfare. So here we might have, you know, people like Blackwater, men with guns doing private security details, might have interrogators like the ones you saw in Abu Ghraib. You might have people who are doing, you know, sort of an analysis and tracking of you know, suspects who are considered, you know, threats to the United States. The important thing to understand about this is because this really has happened because the transformation of the U.S. from a standing army that was based on draftees to a volunteer army, which is much smaller. So, and a lot of people would not be willing to be drafted if their job was cleaning toilets.
There's allegations that the U.S. government hired Blackwater, for example, for a targeted assassination program and to arm U.S. drones. Is the U.S. government still contracting with this company, and to what extent are they doing so?
The U.S. government has multiple contracts with Blackwater. Their most famous contracts over the years has been the contract to protect U.S. diplomats and high-ranking officials. Those contracts have never been canceled. The Iraq government has said that they will not allow Blackwater men to operate in Iraq, but the Afghan government has not said that. So it's my understanding that the alleged contract to arm drones and to use Blackwater operatives to track down quote-unquote terrorists has been suspended or canceled. But there may well be other programs out there that we don't know of.
Should the U.S. government be using private military contractors at all?
I don't think the U.S. government should be involved in a policy of killing people without without a due process of law. And so the use of either soldiers or contractors to assassinate so-called terrorists is to me a violation of human rights. Should they be using contractors to cook food and clean toilets? The simple answer is the United States should not be going to war in these countries. Whether or not they use private contractors is something that is dictated by the fact that American soldiers don't want to go to war.
So basically, as long as these wars continue, it seems that the number of contractors will continue to rise or to be stable.
Until and unless they stop those wars, I think the use of contractors is not, it is military doctrine. It is U.S. government policy. Obama has stated that he wants to make sure that these contractors don't overcharge and they are not involved in human rights abuses, but in no way has he suggested that he would reduce, he would stop using contractors. He has tried to turn over certain of the most problematic areas over to the federal government, and such as, for example, the oversight of contractors currently is now done by contractors. And Obama has realized that this is fraught with conflicts of interest. And so he has suggested, I think, hiring in the next year 11,000 new federal employees to do contract oversight.
That was investigative journalist Protap Chatterjee. To find out more about U.S. military contractors, visit www.corpwatch.org. In Honduras today, the Organization of American States continued meetings in Tegucigalpa. The OAS mission is there to pressure the Roberto Micheletti de facto government to accept a political resolution to the 58-day-old Honduran conflict, but they might not have an easy job. The Honduran Supreme Court has said the proposal is unconstitutional, and the de facto president is also rejecting the mediation plan known as the San Jose Agreement. FSRN's Tim Russo has the story.
The OAS delegation comes just as the Honduran Supreme Court publicly expressed an opinion objecting to 10 of 12 points in the San Jose Agreement. The San Jose Agreement was proposed by Costa Rican President Oscar Arias and is supported by the United States, United Nations, and OAS as a suitable resolution to the Honduran conflict. The OAS delegation is in Honduras to pressure the de facto Micheletti government into accepting the San Jose Agreement, according to Chancellor Bruno Stagno of Costa Rica.
What we need is a public, concrete, decisive declaration by both sides that they support all of the points in the San Jose Agreement.
The official position of the de facto government continues to be in line with the Supreme Court's opinion. They say that the primary sticking points in the San Jose Agreement are amnesty and the restitution of deposed President Manuel Zelaya. They say both points are unconstitutional. De facto President Roberto Micheletti spoke Monday about the OAS mission.
Nobody can come here to impose absolutely anything on us. This is an independent and sovereign country, and we have our own laws. Our June 28th position was based on the Constitution, and we are not going to change our position. No one can come here to tell us what we have to do.
Also in Honduras this week, Spanish Judge Baltasar Garzón is holding a public conference about the process of presenting cases to the International Criminal Court. Guillermo Pérez, Secretary General of the International Federation for Human Rights, based in Brussels, organized Judge Garzón's visit with the following intentions.
To launch a message of prevention to the coup regime that if they continue to commit massive human rights violations, sooner or later, the international community is going to investigate and judge these crimes, if they are not investigated and judged in Honduras.
Again this morning, anti-coup protesters were in the streets for the 59th consecutive day since the June 28th coup. Representatives from the diverse movement were meeting with both the OAS and Garzón, confirming their determination to continue demonstrating until Zelaya's return to power. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tegucigalpa.
And now we go to India, where a delayed and deficient monsoon season has severely affected farmers. Nearly a third of the country's districts are experiencing drought, and communities there are facing a grave situation. The affected areas include some of the most populous and poor states, where many, including the farmers, are struggling to get by. The drought has already pushed the prices of many essential commodities up, and is also expected to slow down the country's economic growth. From New Delhi, FSRN's Bismillah Gilani has the story.
About 100 farmers are protesting at the district collector's office in Meerut town, located in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. They burn effigies of the state government officials and threaten to commit suicide if the government doesn't provide them with immediate relief. At least 5 farmers took their lives in the last 2 weeks alone. The farmers say the government is turning a blind eye to their plight. Akhilesh Kumar is a farmers' union leader in Meerut.
We have nothing to eat, no water to drink. Our crops have dried up. We have lost everything, but nobody cares. So what shall we do? How can we live like this? The only option for us is that we also die.
Uttar Pradesh is among the 11 Indian states that are reeling under severe drought. And with no signs of rainfall in the coming days, the threat looms large over many other regions. Most of the farmers have either lost their entire crops or haven't been able to sow the seeds at all. However, the central government says there is no need to worry as they are fully prepared to deal with the situation. Pranab Mukherjee is the finance minister.
There is no point of pressing the panic button because if I just go on chanting drought, 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 it is having adverse impact. It will not give me any relief. So all the measures which are necessary. In 1987, this country managed the century's worst drought. Therefore, this country has the experience, capability of handling the situation, and I will advise not to press the panic button.
The government also claims that a contingency plan has been put to action, but some experts are not satisfied. Food policy analyst Devinder Sharma says the authorities have once again been caught unawares and ill-prepared.
Every time when the monsoon suffers or monsoon is erratic, we have been caught off the guard. And this is a tragedy that, you know, we haven't actually done anything when it comes to drought proofing. And you know, even now, if the rainfall becomes normal, we'll forget about this dry spell.
The drought has caused a significant drop in the production of food grain, pushing the food prices up by almost 30%. And with India being the second largest producer of sugar, wheat and rice, the global prices of these commodities are also rising. Agriculture expert Viraj Patnaik says the situation will get even more difficult in the days ahead.
What is significantly different about this time's drought is that it is a triple effect. Firstly, you have a global meltdown. Now, we as a nation have been pretending that this global meltdown has not really affected us. And that's not really true, because if you just take the one district of Ganjam in Orissa, you have about 400,000 migrant labor who had jobs in the gems and jewelry sector who are now coming back to their farmlands looking for jobs, looking for employment, but there isn't any available. So there is a global meltdown that's affecting. Secondly, there is a global food crisis that is ongoing. So this time, I think the drought is going to have a far deeper impact.
Agriculture is one of the strongholds of the Indian economy, contributing nearly 20% to the gross domestic product, or GDP. It's also a source of livelihood for more than half of the population. But much of the farming in India relies heavily on rainwater, and drought has been a recurring problem. Many blame government's mismanagement of water resources for the crisis. Gargi Parsai is the agricultural affairs editor of the national news daily, The Hindu.
Monsoon ke bharose to hamari 60% kheti hai hi.
60% of our crops still depend on the monsoon, but we have not yet been able to put in place a proper system of irrigation. Some of the projects have been approved of years ago, but they are yet to be completed, and we know that regions like Rajasthan have been frequently facing a drought-like situation. The dams we have been building do not come to our rescue because their upkeep remains a problem. The same is the case with all other reservoirs. This is grossly neglectful, and it shows that the government is not really serious in dealing with the crisis.
But others say the primary problem is a farming policy that ignores the ground reality. Again, food policy analyst Sharma.
In the dryland regions of India, common sense tells us we should be growing crops which require less water. We had ample number of drought-resistant varieties, but what the modern science has done is replace them with hybrids. And it's the official system has gone around asking farmers to replace your seeds with hybrids. Now, hybrid seeds, the water requirement for hybrid seeds is roughly 50 to 100% more than the high-yielding varieties that we grow in Punjab and Haryana.
Experts like Sharma say that in order to solve the problem permanently, the country needs to rethink its current agricultural policy and develop a sustainable model of farming that is not dependent on the rainfall pattern India is used to. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And now FSRN has a correction to make. On Monday, August 17th, we heard a story by Andrew Stelzer on the RNC 8. That included an assertion that a spokesperson for the Ramsey County's attorney's office would not comment specifically on any connection between the RNC 8 and other cases. In fact, the spokesperson refused to comment further on the cases in general. The story also incorrectly stated that one of the charges against the RNC 8 was conspiracy to destroy federal property. The charge was actually conspiracy to destroy property. Additionally, we stated 37 people pleaded guilty to charges brought by Ramsey County. In fact, that's the number of people who pleaded guilty to charges brought by the City of St. Paul, Ramsey County, and the federal government combined. FSRN regrets the errors and any misunderstanding this may have created. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliates, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Today's newscast was produced by Vinod K. Jose and Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Nell Abram. FSRN's intern is Shuhei Nakayama. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.